This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
Up on the roof. Up on the roof. When this old world starts getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face.
Up on the roof.
I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space.
On the roof.
On the roof is peaceful as can be. And there the world below can't bother me. Let me tell you now, when I come home feeling tired and weak, I go up where the air fresh and sweet. I get away from the hustling crowd and all that rat race noise down in the street. On the roof, the only place I know, where you just have to wish to make it so. At night the stars put on a show for free, and darling, you can share it all with me. I keep a telling you right smack dab in the middle of town, I found a paradise that's trouble-proof. And if starts getting you down, there's room enough for two up on the roof. Up on the roof. Oh, come on, baby. Oh, come on,
it's time for the Carol Cox Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Hey, good morning, and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. We're sitting here, going to be talking a bit about bees here. As you know, for some while we've talked about concerns for the decline in bee population, and there's many theories and that are occurring out there and being tossed around. We talk about pesticides, we talk about the small hive beetle, we talk about the mite, we talk about NGO. GMOs, nicotinoids, pesticides, you name it. So I have Howard McGinnis back with us. You recall Howard is a bee man, and make sure you run out and get your pencil so you can record his phone number when you see a swarm of bees. Don't spray them, and don't kill them, and don't harass them. They won't bother you. Call Howard, and Howard has a plan for them. He can incorporate them and try to keep them healthy, take every one of them away. Also, with him is Kim Falinski, and she's a grad student, right, from CTAR, the College of Tropical Ag and Research, I guess. So, Howard, since we last talked, I had bees around my house singing and buzzing, and, you know, it was nice. Now, it's a quiet, almost a deafening silence. Occasionally, if it's not for the bumblebee, large black Bombas, and the male, the gold one, I really wouldn't hear any buzz. So let us know, and good morning.
Good morning, Carol. I'm trying to remember when you and I first met. There was a swarm at Tina's place, and it may have been 2010.
Mm-hmm.
When we had that little bee outing, when you came out and visited us out at Loon Farms and saw, you know, us fighting the beetles along with the University of Hawaii, we had an increase in the bee population that seemed, we'll never have the bees that we used to have, the population that we used to have. But they were making a comeback, and with the arrival of the small hive beetle, it seems to be doing some damage, you know, keeping the populations from there.
Mm-hmm.
The pests that we have are here. The mite is still here. The small hive beetle is still here. One of the questions that Kim and I are asked at the market all the time is, you know, how are the bees going? I guess the mite problem's been resolved because it's just not in the news anymore. Mm-hmm. The small hive beetle has maybe made one appearance in the news. There's not a lot of discussion about it. But just to recap some of the, you know, problems that we've had, Hawaii had no pests until 2007. We were a great place to raise bees. 2007, we had the mite. In 2010, we picked up the small hive beetle. The mite decimated the beekeeping industry in 2007, and you're seeing the results of that, not seeing bees, you know, where you're at. The small hive beetle arrived in the Big Island in 2010, spread to Oahu. It's now in Molokai. It's now on Maui. It may be on Lanai. Mm-hmm. John DeLeary, another beekeeper on Oahu who has bees on Lanai, says they found one beetle on Lanai, which I find really fascinating that they could find one beetle. Between the two pests, the beetle's much more serious for us because of the speed at which it can work.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the hives that you visited in 2010 with when you came out to the farms, those hives are gone. They've been replaced with new hives, but the ones that were out there in 2010 just they don't make it. The beetle, you know, works its magic and will actually kill the hive.
Mm-hmm. Stress it out, and you predicted that. You were describing that when we were there. You said that at the pace that these bugs or beetles were there, as we were looking at it, you said if at the current pace,
yes,
that would be clean, and they're all gone now.
Everybody's been having problems. The Big Island has had a terrible problem with it. Here we gain hives and we lose hives. The one problem with the small hive beetles, it seems to take out our big hives, the big strong colonies, because there's a lot of adult bees, and the beetles are attracted to the pheromones that, you know, the adult bees and larvae produce. So mm-hmm. they become a target for the beetle. The beetle itself has a pheromone that it puts out that calls other beetles, and pretty soon you have a beetle party going on in the hive. And as long as the hive is strong, it's okay. The university calls the varroa and beetle like a 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm.
The varroa mite weakens the hive, and it allows the beetle an opportunity to lay its eggs. The eggs will hatch, the larva will destroy the hive, and it can do it in as little as 4 days. I've watched a hive basically die out in 4 days. So it's much faster. Mite is a slow death. You know, we can treat for that. We have some good materials.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember when the mite away, when did we do that?
When we last treated or when did they start using it?
Mm-hmm.
Probably in 2008. I mean, just not too long after.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that's interesting, he said it, he talked about the turnover rate. Mm-hmm. But we have, I mean, I had hives that I had kept for my whole 6 years beekeeping that I lost this winter for the first time. So you have a hive that really continues on for a long time, but the small hive beetle is serious enough that it's knocking out those long-term hives,
mm-hmm.
which the turnover isn't good. It isn't good because you don't know the hive as well, and they're not going to be as good producers.
Now, if you two could explain or share with us the small hive beetle, how is it impacting? Is it consuming the larvae? Is it consuming the food? And then if you could, I think that the varroa mite is actually parasitizing the larvae. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the bee, adult
bees. And the
bee.
Adult bees as well.
So could you just share with us what's the difference or what stresses they bring?
The mite is tightly coupled to the bee. It requires the larva to reproduce. So if there were, you know, lower bee population, less mite population, nature has a way of keeping it in check. The varroa mite takes about a year to 2 years to totally cause the hive to collapse and die off.
Mm-hmm.
And in that period of time, if we're keeping on top of things, we notice through the brood pattern inside the hive the way the queen is laying eggs, we can see that we have a mite problem. The mite also brings a deformed wing virus, so we'll see bees outside the hive with deformed wings, and that's an indication that, you know, that we have a mite problem, and we can treat for that. We
mm-hmm.
In Hawaii, we have a formic acid concoction that is very effective, does not affect the honey, doesn't require that we pull the honey off the hive, as so many of the other ones do. It's a fast-acting, and the mites don't develop a resistant. The small hive beetle, on the other hand, doesn't really need the bees. It can reproduce in decaying fruits, vegetables, things like this. So
mm-hmm.
it doesn't necessarily need, you know, the bee. So the population of the bees really doesn't affect the population of the small hive beetle.
Mm-hmm.
The beetle will infiltrate the hives. They travel usually a half hour after sunset, and they'll start arriving at the hive. They're very good flyers. They can detect a hive from about 10 miles. So they look
like little tea kettles to me,
mm-hmm.
like flying tea kettles,
because mm-hmm.
they're just hard and round and strong, and they
right.
can really fly. They're strong little things.
They'll come in at night. Because they're a beetle, and like she says, they're hard-shelled, the bees really don't have a defense against them. They can't sting them.
Mm-hmm.
The beetle will pull its legs in and sort of act like a turtle, so it's just a shell. So they have a pretty good defense, you know, against them. The bees will try to corral the beetle. They'll jam them into the corners of the hive in our managed colonies. They'll have a jailer bee whose job it is to make sure that the beetles don't stray off there. As long as the hive is strong, they can do this. We do have some things that we can use for them, oil-based traps
mm-hmm.
that the beetles will seek refuge in to get away from the bees, and they'll get coated with oil and they'll drown. It's a lot of work for us,
right.
Because the traps can fill up quickly. They consume a lot of oil. I've done some damage to hives by forgetting that I have these traps in and tilting the hive.
Right.
And causing the oil to run out. And the oil will kill the bees just as well. There's no real chemical that we can use against the beetle because the beetle resides in the hive with the bees. And anything we would use inside the hive to kill the beetle will also affect the bees itself. The beetle will try to lay eggs. Then bees will try to keep the beetles from laying eggs. If the bees are diligent, they find the eggs, they'll eat them. You know, it's a protein, so they'll
mm-hmm.
they'll go ahead and gobble them up. But if they get distracted and those eggs hatch, the larva is what does the damage in the hive. The larva will go for the pollen, the bee larva, bee pupa. And as they're munching their way through the hive, they're excreting a wild yeast-like substance, which mm-hmm. causes the honey to ferment. it also causes the bees not to go into that area of the hive. And so that allows the adult beetles more opportunities to lay.
To mate and lay.
And what will happen is that the hive will result in a slime out. And this is where the fermenting honey just kind of drenches the hive, ends up on the bottom board of the hive with the beetle larva. And the larva will leave the hive. They'll spend some time in the hive. They'll leave, burrow into the ground. The beetle comes from South Africa, dry climate. Mm-hmm. And apparently that keeps the population down because it's not an economic problem in South Africa.
So it's an invasive species.
Yes.
And again, if you could touch on, how do we suspect that it was introduced here, mainland first, or
it arrived
Big Island first? Where,
yeah,
if
you
could?
It arrived in South Carolina in 1996, mm-hmm. and it was, I guess, officially identified in Florida in 1998. It spread probably through flying from place to place or migratory beekeeping. And arrived here in 2010. So it took a little bit of a time to get here. How it got here, I don't think we'll ever know. It could have come in on shipments of fruit. Mm-hmm. These beetles they're great flyers, and they're small enough to get into small crevices. They could come in any kind of package.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been that, possibly a beekeeper wanting a bee that was more resistant to varroa, maybe illegally brought some bees into Hawaii. That mm-hmm. does happen. They, mm-hmm. they have intercepted packages of bees and queens coming in. Maybe there was some small hive beetle eggs mm-hmm. in there. And the thing with invasive species is if you're not looking for them, by the time you detect them, it's too late. It's going to be too well entrenched, and Hawaii is such a great climate for pests like this.
Yeah.
So this slime out, the larva will go into the ground, go through their pupa stage, and they'll emerge as adults. If you don't catch that, you're making a lot of beetles. If you're a farmer and you're disking under zucchinis, you're providing habitat for these things to to go through their larval stage and then pupate in the ground.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. What would you suggest to farmers and maintaining areas that where you find beehives or where you actually have a collection of hives? What do you suggest the farmers do to avoid the fruit laying around, or what do you prescribe?
Carol, that's a good question. That's one I wish I'd had asked.
The simple answer, I think, is to keep strong hives.
Yeah.
If you have a strong hive, then they can defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are managing the hive well, it's harder to do than it sounds. So.
And the problem with the farms are you can't ask them not to disk their product under. One is it's a fertilizer of sort.
Right.
Two, the labor to haul it off and dispose of it some other way would be, prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem with farmers, the large farms, is that the pesticides that they use have a tendency sometimes to weaken the hive. So that sometimes it's difficult to have a strong hive,
mm-hmm.
If they're overusing or misapplying pesticides. So when we work with farmers, we try to get them to apply pesticides at the right time. We recommend that they use a pesticide that's bee-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they're in it for business. Their
right.
business is to produce food for us to eat, and mm-hmm. Pesticides are a normal part of their, their business in the large farms. I guess the smaller farmers that, either can't afford pesticides. But like Kim says, strong hives are our biggest defense against the beetle.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that he mentioned to me, Howard talks to me a lot, is that the the big farms often have periods of downtime, right, mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. there aren't any crops being grown, and that also might weaken the hives. So if you have a farm and you have nothing for the bees to eat, and if it's a big enough farm that they can't really access any nectar, mm-hmm. then that actually might – we're not feeding our hives. We, in particular, mm-hmm. aren't feeding our hives, mm-hmm. and so they may not have enough food to keep them running. So.
Now, there are many questions out there, and two things that if you could speak to. One, the bee itself, the honeybee, as we know it, is a non-native species.
Correct.
So, right. So what's the general thought about, are we concerned that maybe this is a species that was introduced and it's playing out, or and it's an artificial? Just out of curiosity, can you share your thoughts, or have anyone given, or have you been challenged with those questions?
Well, the Hawaii Department of Agriculture actually lists the honeybee as a pest because it's a very efficient forager, mm-hmm. and there's maybe 60 species of native Hawaiian bees, which are solitary. Mm-hmm. The honeybee is a social, highly social insect, and large colonies, up to 60,000 bees. So they list it as a pest. They recognize that, you know, it has affected Hawaii's ecosystem and Hawaii's insects. I think last year I read where they were concerned about silver sword,
mm-hmm.
because it's a native Hawaiian bee that pollinates it, and usually it's at an altitude, I guess, where bees don't normally,
right.
you know, visit. The bee was brought here about 150 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and its primary, you know, crops that it pollinates here is probably the melons, watermelon, mm-hmm.
Macadamia.
Those are the two big.
Mm-hmm.
Those
yeah.
are the two, you know, the two big ones, and they'll prop them up. Are they having being an introduced species? Are they reaching the end of their, mm-hmm. you know, usefulness here? No, I don't think so.
In that sense, for the purpose of commercial ag. Probably not, but just out of, you know, in the scheme of things, have we considered that maybe this is, you know, the down the road introducing the species for the purpose of agricultural purposes to get the foods that we like, not the natives. So just was curious, and maybe are there some answers or solution to their decline in reviewing that and looking back, and if so,
Hawaii's different than the mainland in crop productions.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to have more diversified agriculture, whereas the mainland tends to have more monocrops. And this morning, to just fill you in, Carol and I were talking about one of the theories that's now coming is that the monocrop farming on the mainland is starting to result in the decline of the bee population.
Let's see if we can get this call. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question?
Oh, what's up, Carol Cox?
Good morning. How can we help you today, Jay?
I have a question. I heard you guys are talking about the whole, like, food thing. You know, I heard you talking about, like, the, you know, like honey and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually have a question about, like, what's up with this whole, like, Boston bombing story?
Well, we'll talk about that later, Jake. But if you'd like to tune in, you got any questions right now on the bees?
Yeah.
Real quick, what's your question on the bees? You got a comment or question real quick?
Well, I think, like, the bees live in a good home. They eat, like, good food, you know, they have a good home, and, you know.
Okay. Well, keep tuning in and listening, and if you have any more questions or thoughts, call me back and share them, all right?
Okay.
Thank you. Bye. Go ahead.
Well, the caller mentioned about bees living in good homes and having good food, and I think Kim brought up the one thing is in – within our farming, our large farms, you know, the possibility of starvation is there when the fields are fallow. Or we grow a lot of crops that just don't produce flowers, a lot of onions, a lot of, I guess, cauliflower, bok choy.
So one thing that would be useful for the big farms is cover crops, and I just haven't seen too much about this, but both from an erosion standpoint and also from the bee point, if you could grow a crop in there that might provide for them in the interperiod, then you don't need to supplement them with sugar, water, or whatever kind of other feeding. I mean, when you feed bees, it's kind of like putting them on an IV, right? You're going to feed them sugar, and you're going to feed them protein in some amount, and it can't be as good as regular flowers. So.
Now, the ultimate goal, there's, I guess, two important needs or uses for bees. One, the type of crops that we grow, the food sources and the food stuff that we eat as humans, we've become, and they are directly related to the pollinization, right? So we have brought the bee in to accompany and accommodate our type of agriculture that we have now. Now this issue of GMO is introduced. Is that the double-edged sword? If you could, I mean, there's many issues about it.
Well, the crops that are GMO are generally, I think right now, forgive me if I'm wrong here, but most of them are not bees are not grabbing nectar from them. Am I wrong on that?
No, you'd be right, because our big ones are corn, which they will collect pollen from.
From the tassels.
And
papaya.
Papaya, which a long time ago, I believe I heard that the farmers or the papaya growers really weren't interested in bees as a pollinator, because they can take pollen from a undesirable papaya and pollinate a good papaya, you know, changing the way that produces fruit. I think, do we grow soy here?
No, not really. No soy.
Just a little bit. There's a few people.
So from that perspective, I think I used to think like, oh, no, it's, you know, whatever. The bees aren't really going to crops that are GMO. But then at the same time, a lot of the GMO, say corn or other things that are grown here, are adapted to be able to handle more pesticides. And so if the pesticides are a problem in any way for the bee, then having a crop that can handle more pesticide load intentionally, right? So now I can dump 2 gallons instead of 1 gallon on this. Well, that might actually have some negative effect. But there's really no data to show that. It's more just a thought.
Yeah, because if we're saying that the GMO is impacting the bees, I'm sure there are many theories out there, and people on one side is arguing, the other saying no. But what could we do to enhance the population of bees, not wait until we change our crops and rotate them? How about our backyards, and how about along the highways, and the type of plants that we plant, and beautification? You're damned if you do and damned if you don't, because if you introduce a lot of flowering plants like lupus longiflora or, bells, the bluebells, the blue bonnets, great legume that attracts bees. I mean, you want to see bees, go to see the Lady Bird Johnson's bluebells along the highway. But they're an alien species.
So I was going to say, what
a dilemma. What could we do to...
You have native plant people that want to go out there and, replant all the highways in Maui with native plant. Like, there's a huge project. But those plants are likely not going to be happy for bees. The happiest things for bees here are things like Christmasberry, which is a weed tree.
Yeah, the pepper tree, Brazilian pepper tree.
So... I don't know which one you want to do, but I think in people's backyard they have more leave, but I'm not sure about highway programs.
Yeah.
How that would work.
I'm just watching this play out because my head's spinning, because you got, on one hand, even myself, I eat honey and most of our products now, even when we speak of it being good and healthy and green, it has honey. Right? Honey and oats and honey nuts and honey almonds, right?
Right.
But are we willing to give that up to save the bee, or are we willing to give that up to save the native plant species? We're at the crossroads, I think, in modern times.
Well, and again, I think Hawaii has is a special case because there are so many species here that are unique to the Hawaiian Islands, you know, grow no place else. And maybe they don't have the flowers. Maybe they're not as pretty, you know, and so there is this, well, we want to see colors in our gardens. We want to see flowers. You know, let's plant some things that look nice as opposed to, you know, something that was here. So it is a difficult. In the mainland where there, you know, where there's clover, and again, this could be one of the problems, too, with the monocrop, you know, where you're just growing clover. If you're just growing corn or soy or whatever they get canola oil from. You know, it's just a monocrop and the beet, that's all they get. So there's a paper circulating now that is broaching the theory that this is one of the reasons for the decline of the bee is that monocrop. They don't have the diversity in pollens and nectars that they have had in the past. And it's just like us eating one food all the time.
You know, like corn, which I think we do.
It's not healthy for us. We were meant to eat a diversified, you know, plate of foods. And if we were to focus just on one, we would most likely start suffering, you know, some effects as well. The backyard habitat's making something that is attracted to pollinators. And one of the things that I want to just mention is that while we look at honeybees as a pollinator, all too often we think of honeybees as the only pollinator. And we forget the other pollinators, you know, on the island, the carpenter bees, the black bumblebees. We forget leaf cutter bees and hover flies and sweat bees and moths and ants. And, you know, there's a lot of pollinators. We often forget, too, that just because it's a flower doesn't mean that the honeybee is interested in it. Each plant has evolved to produce a flower and a nectar to attract, you know, a type of pollinator. The size of the flower, the shape of the flower, you know, depends on what type of pollinator might visit it. A flower with a really long bell, you know, would maybe more suited for a moth or a butterfly with a very long tongue, and not a honeybee. The carpenter bee is more suited for, like, lilikoi. Bees don't like, you know, they're not fond of lilikoi. A lot of the crops that we give bees credit for pollinating, mango, avocado, they're not their favorite. They go to them, but it's not their favorite. Given the choice between a nice orange tree, any citrus, which is overproduces nectar, you know, just to attract pollinators, those are more attractive to honeybees. So
things like basil, anything with a really tiny white flower, you can generally assume is looking at or trying to pull in a honeybee.
I am interested, you mentioned that I was just a week ago over photographing basil fields, thinking in the terms of it's there and you know it attracts bees. The problem is their harvesting of it, and also they spray it.
They spray it. They also cut the flowers off.
And they cut the flowers off. Right. So it's you're bringing them there, and then at what time are you going to spray them, and what time? So
that would be a great tip for farmers, is to let them know that bees have a schedule, just like humans do. Like they wake up and have their cup of coffee, and then they, like, go to the bathroom, and then they go and collect nectar, and then they take a nap.
I raise that because that's why that's one of the little things that in the back of my mind, I'm not scientific about it in approaching it, but just looking at basil, and we see an explosion of basil fields here, right? In every canyon, every vacant lot now, there is an effort to grow basil. But are we actually raising it, inviting the bee in, and then at what time are we spraying it? It's about the equivalent, in my opinion, of putting fly paper up for the bee, because they're going to come, and you're going to spray it. And I mean, I haven't sat down and count every dead bee, but I just say that that's something.
I think
the practices and the spraying and the cutting and the manipulating of the crops and the preparation would also contribute, in my opinion, to the decline.
I think that, you know, one of the things that you're pointing out is, you know, it's attempting to reduce the amount of pesticides, to look at other methods for controlling, mm-hmm. you know, the pests. And I attended an integrated pest management conference last year, and there's things that you can do that don't involve pesticides. I guess they're using, like, a reflective mulch.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things where the universities work really well with, you know, to for the farmer to reach out. And if they are concerned about, you know, the use of pesticides, and especially with the basil, I think just recently we had the farm out in Eva that I guess was using the wrong pesticide.
Right.
And, you know, it not only do they have to, you know, remove all that product from the shelf, they have to uproot all the, you know, the plants, and what effect has that had? You know, are there non-pesticide methods of, you know, dealing with some of the mm-hmm. the pests?
Yeah. I distract you. I was saying you have a bottle of honey here, and with how do people reach you? We've been talking. I got Howard McGinnis here and Kim Fillon. And I wanted you to not give a plug, but give a plug. For
oh,
your,
you know it's going to be a plug.
But also the reason I wanted to mention that just the other day I was down at KHON and a call came in and there was a bee
swarm.
Yeah.
Right alongside. And I tried to call. We tried to call you. And then I think Michael Clicks
got it.
Got it. But if you could, can you talk about your – how do we contact you? And also your company or your honey, and as well, please, if you could give great emphasis on what can people do, what should they do when they see a swarm of bees?
And be excited. How lucky.
Yeah,
how lucky is that?
Yeah.
That's great.
Hold that thought. I had this caller waiting. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question?
Yeah, I live on the windward side. I have about maybe 30 avocado trees on my 4.5-acre lot. And I have a mountain apple tree, and I used to see honeybees come by the mountain apple when they pollinate the flowers and whatnot. My concern is the bees in the wild. If we see a hive, you know, maybe in a tree or whatever, isn't there where we can contact you and maybe, I don't know, maybe put a GPS lock on those bees when go hiking so you folks can analyze if they have the mites in their hive?
We're always interested in any wild or feral colonies for several reasons. One, just to know where they're at, to know possibly when we get a swarm in a residential area where the parent hive might be. It is also a way for us to assess, you know, the health of wild colonies. I keep track of it. You can always call, Carol is mine, I'll give out the number. You can reach me at 808-258-7296. We also are on the web at www.nalo-melly.com.
Uh-huh.
And you'll find wonderful pictures of both me and Kim there.
Sorry about that.
Carol's laughing, obviously. You've seen it.
Well, no. I just you are sitting here and you're telling people to go to your website to see your honey.
Yeah.
Well, we have the honey in there, but we also have some things on.
It would be the best way to contact us for things like that. So if you did see a hive, so you say you have a hive that you know of in the wild.
Yeah.
That's great to know. I'm not really sure what kind of samples we can take, but to just know that hive is probably populating its area. Because uh-huh. once it gets too big, then it'll throw off half of its bees into a new place.
Yeah.
So,
And unlike some of the other organizations out there who will destroy the hive, we have a tendency to let wild hives, as long as they're not a public nuisance or causing problems, you know, we just like to keep aware of it and maybe put some swarm traps out around the hive so that maybe we can grab some bees from it when the hive does swarm. The important thing when you see a swarm of bees is, one, to not really panic. we get calls, you know, bees, got bees, you got to come and save us. The world is going to stop turning if you don't come and get them right away.
Yeah.
It's important that you call right away, because when a swarm lands someplace, they're looking for a home. They're looking for a tree. They're looking for maybe a rock crevice. They're looking at your double wall house,
right,
trying to find where Larry the cable guy didn't plug that puka up. And, you know, 20,000 bees can move inside your the walls of your house in 5 minutes.
Right.
So it's important that if you do see a swarm that you call. And it doesn't have to be us. It can. I believe there's a pest hotline that the state maintains that will put you in touch with the university, who will then probably call us. You can also call 911. They will they'll call a beekeeper. There's a state vector control that you can call. Again, we're on those lists, and they rotate through the beekeepers. When Kim said, you know, be happy about seeing a swarm, the opportunity to see a swarm, it's an amazing thing, and it really is generally a sign of a healthy colony somewhere.
Right.
For beekeepers, you do not know how excited we get about a swarm of bees. And
right.
I will drop anything that I'm doing, and I will travel to any part of this island to grab a swarm. Because this is, unlike the mainland, we cannot bring bees in. So I can't call up a packaged bee producer and say, well, you know, I lost 10 hives. I need you to send me 10 packages of bees.
Right.
The only way we can do bees is either through catching swarms, splitting existing hives, which when we split a hive weakens them, and we've had some bad experiences with that. So a swarm for us is, it's a, I don't know if this is the right word, but it's joyous. I just start getting giddy about catching a swarm of bees.
And you have a theory, or several theories, on why they do swarm. Is it because of the impact of the stress, and this is a portion of a colony just decide to pick up and leave?
Well, bees will swarm. It's a naturally occurring thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point at which the space that they have, they cannot store any more honey. They can't draw any more comb. The queens can't lay any more eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're bringing in so much stuff that this is a natural thing they do for the species to replicate. Half the bees will leave and go start another colony somewhere.
It's so amazing, because how do they know which half is going to leave? They just split themselves up. It's a pretty amazing process to watch. And once they start, you can't stop them for anything. There's nothing that will make them stop swarming.
And when I was at your colony a couple of years back, you were talking about where the stress from the mites and whatever it may cause some to pick
right.
up. And
that's a different – that's called an absconded hive.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between a swarm and an absconded hive is a swarm is a planned evolution.
Mm-hmm.
The bees have been thinking about this because it's getting crowded. They will send out scouts to try to find a new location. They'll tank up on nectar before they leave, and then someday, you know, half of them will pour out. And like Kim says, I'm still trying to figure out how they know what half. Are you in the half that goes, or are you in the half that stays? You know, how do you know when half the bees are out of the hive? Nobody's counting them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of mysteries in there. An absconded hive is different in that for some reason the bees are disturbed. Either the beetle loading is too big, there's no food, or the hive has been disturbed. A lot of times, if you have a telephone pole that you're using as like a parking stop or something, bees will move inside there. And if you disturb that with some sort of earth mover,
mm-hmm.
you know, the bees will they'll just pick up and leave.
Mm-hmm.
Swarms are very gentle. Absconded hives are they're cranky because this is not planned. They did not plan to leave. You know, something drove them out.
They were evicted.
And
it's a whole different mindset.
They're not happy about it.
But the beetle, we talked about how mm-hmm. nasty it is. It can actually fly with the swarm. So the beetle will actually, they can't really outfly it, which is unfortunate. Because otherwise they could just swarm and, oh, okay, now we're in a better place. But if the beetle's going to fly with you, it sort of defeats the purpose.
Kind of like maybe some of my relatives are part
well,
beetles.
You know, it's the same principle as you move to get away from unwanted house guests, but you don't know they're traveling with you.
Yeah, lose my number.
Yeah.
And we do, we have learned a lot about beetles. Hawaii's been a good laboratory for it because mm-hmm. The beetle is relatively new here. And we have seen where a hive that had a high beetle count, after it swarms, has a low beetle count because all the beetles have left with the swarm.
Oh. Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering how long does it take to make a queen bee when a new hive is made in another area?
When a hive swarms, the old queen leaves with the swarm.
Uh-huh.
The part that stays behind, they will make anywhere from, I don't know, 3 to, I've seen as many as 50 queen cells inside a hive. Generally takes about 15 days from the time the egg is laid till the time the queen will emerge.
Uh-huh.
Usually I estimate maybe 20 to 25 days before she starts laying. And swarming has actually been one of our best mite control strategies. When the hive swarms, the part that remains behind has no egg layer.
Right.
And without an egg layer, there's no place for the mites to reproduce.
Uh-huh.
The part that left, it's going to take them about 25 to 30 days to get enough comb and enough larva going where whatever mites have traveled with the adult bees, they'll start to reproduce. So mm-hmm. it breaks the mite's life cycle,
uh-huh.
and it allows the mite population to drop, allows the bees a chance to, you know, catch a breath of fresh air and, mm-hmm. and do good. But the queen takes roughly around 15 days
uh-huh.
To go from egg to emerge from her cell.
How much of the islands are affected by these mites already?
The mite is present on Oahu, a big island. I believe they may have found some on Maui, but I don't know that for a fact. One of the problems that we do have is that the state agencies are very close-mouthed about, you know, what pests they're finding on what islands. Mm-hmm. The mite, I don't believe the mite's on Lanai. I don't believe it's on Molokai. I don't believe it's on Kauai. The small hive beetle is present on Oahu, Big Island, Molokai, Maui. They claim to have found one on Lanai, and I hear rumors about something on Kauai, but it's not been substantiated.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, concerning the killer bee population coming from South America, how is that affecting the North America right now? Do you know?
Well, the Africanized bees, because they're better suited for a higher temperature, seem to have stopped maybe, I think, as far north as Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Hawaii, and Kim's probably grimacing because I love telling this story, we don't have the Africanized bees here, but what we have is German bees, and these uh-huh. were the first bees that were brought to Hawaii in the 1850s. And they have all the bad attitude of the Africanized bees, only they come by it naturally. Uh-huh. They're very defensive about their hives. They're just like Africanized bees. They look identical to, you know, a regular honeybee, because they really are a regular honeybee.
Uh-huh.
But their temperament is just so much worse.
Right. Thanks for the information.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. Hey, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So I got Howard McGinnis and Kim Falinski, and we're talking bees here on the Carol Cox Show. But I'm holding right now in my hand a tangerine macadamia nut honey. Man, it looks good. Now, you can call Howard at 258-7296. If you see a swarm of bees, please be nice to them and don't spray them. Don't kill them. As I said last time, don't spray. Let them stay. So whatever you do, call 258-7296. And also, they're in Kailua at Nalo Meli, M-E-L-I, so www.nalo-meli, M-E-L-I.com.
You can also find us at, we're at the KCC Farmers Market, Kailua Farmer Market, Mo'olani.
Where else can I, in Mililani?
Yes.
Where else can I get this? Is it on the store anywhere?
No, we do not sell in stores.
Really?
Okay. We like to sell direct to people. We want them to try the honeys.
Okay.
We want them to experience the range of flavors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many on Saturday, how many tastings Kim will do.
A lot.
So now, in quantities.
But then at the same time, Howard will talk story to you while I'm tasting the honey. So come if you have more questions.
The quantity of honey, what quantities can you buy? A half gallon, gallon, quart, or is it whatever the person wishes? And how do they get it? They just call you?
The best way to find us really is to come and show up at one of the farmers markets, but okay. You can either call Howard at that number, 258-7296, okay. Or email me, kim@nalo-belly.com. I'm an emailer myself. Mm-hmm. So if you just find us that way, you can special order. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, we usually save our freshest product for the farmers market. So mm-hmm. We'll try to pull that week and mm-hmm. That's our main difference.
Real quick, I'll try and entertain this call. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question? Oh, what a mess. Anyway, we're coming down in the last couple of minutes. But anything else real quick you got want to share?
Well, keep looking out for bees. Once you start to know what a bee looks like when they're flying, it's really fun to see them everywhere. When you're mm-hmm. driving, when you're walking, keep an eye out for them. Mm-hmm. I like to hike, and so I try to see them on the trails and see where they are and what they're up to. And mm-hmm. just realizing that they're kind of everywhere, and you don't really see them unless you're looking for them.
I have those nice shade belladonias, and there's nothing more beautiful than to hear the bee inside of the bell of that flower, and it amplifies, right? And it's like, wow, a bee! No kidding. There were times you could hear just a symphony, and now I just occasionally hear one or two. And I have a bottle brush, and I have a...
May I ask what valley? What?
Mililani.
Mililani, mm-hmm. Okay.
I think Kim was just on Maui. Was it Maui that you went to recently? And, you know, the bee population is
so healthy.
So healthy there compared to Oahu. And mm-hmm. and it really becomes demoralizing sometimes to come back to Oahu because, you know, Maui, you're at the airport, and you look up in the, you know, the palm trees, and there's all these bees around the flowers, and you mm-hmm. come to Oahu, and it's like you really have to work to find bees, you know, like it used to be before 2007.
Right. Okay, well, thank you guys for staying and joining in with me and talking about bees. And any other time you want to come back, don't hesitate. Because
thanks for having us.
Let's see here. Caller, good morning. You have a comment or question?
Awesome, Carol Cox.
Going okay, man. You got a question real quick? Because I'm coming down at the last minute. Better speak or we're gone.
You guys are talking about, like, the bees, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So,
did somebody say, like, they lived in Mililani or anything?
Yeah, you and I live in Mililani, remember?
Oh, yeah.
We're friends, we live in Mililani together. Yeah, so, we're gonna have to get together and hook up and talk, all right?
Hey, Carol.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm fine, and I got to go. I'm got down to the last minute, and Howard got some more to tell you about bees real quick. So take care, and I'll talk to you later, all right?
All right.
Take care. But anyway, that's we have great callers, and I mean.
So please come and find us. We love to talk about this stuff, and there's so much to learn about bees. You can learn about it forever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the last plug I'd like to make, if it's all right with you, is it's important that people support the local beekeeping community by buying local honey. We realize it's more expensive mm-hmm. than a mainland honey, but when you buy from a local beekeeper. You're helping that beekeeper support his bees. You're helping him or her.
Him or her. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
You know, deal with the issues that are, you know, bothering bees. It allows us to, you know, to increase our populations, mm-hmm. but only through supporting your local beekeeper. If you're buying a mainland honey, which is, it's good honey, it's money that's leaving the state. It doesn't help us keep bees going here.
All right, Howard McGinnis and Kim Falinski, thank you for joining me. And this is nalomeli.com, nalo-meli.com, 258-7296. Thank you for joining me, and I'll see you in the next hour. Aloha.
Bye.
And by the way, If you're out there at Jameson Beach at Haleiwa, they're having a beach cleanup. And if you know how to snorkel, dive, they got tanks. They'll give you air. Bring gloves. At 2 to 5 p.m., they're going to actually have a beach cleanup, removing all the tires and everything, other junks in the ocean out there. So that's at Jameson's, and it's bringing Deep Ecology Hawaii. You can call them at 637-7946, Deep Ecology Hawaii. Go out there. It's Earth Day, so let's do it, man. Aloha.
He also might.
Thank you for... Stay tuned for the second half of the Carol Cox Show right after the news on KWAI Honolulu, K108.
Listening to the train. And I used to pick up a handful of gravels and throw them down on the ground for time. Yeah, and I'd make up songs. I'd sing. He was a railroad man. Was a railroad. Was a railroad man till he stepped in front of the railroad train. He rode across the plain, rode on a fruit freight train. They hauled bananas to Savannah, wore bandanas made in old Japan. Was a railroad man.
It's time for the Carol Cox Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Okay, welcome back to the Carol Cox Show, and a couple of things, and I still have Kim Falinski and Howard McGinnis in. We were talking about bees and a few things of close up with, but I want to remind you out there at Haleiwa, there's a beach cleanup remember, this is Earth Day, and if you don't give a hoot, get out there anyway. And it's Earth Day. It's where you live, and it's where you play, and people dump on it. And go out there and see what you can do. Pick up some, get off your butts and go pick up cigarette butts or whatever. But do something. Make the place look a little better, and it'll be okay. But Deep Ecology at Haleiwa, Deep Ecology Hawaii, 637-7946. They ask that you come out. And anybody that has diving experience, they'll provide the air tanks and snorkel gear, and just get on out there and see what we can do to pitch in. And that's about it. So Kim and Howard. Howard has an interesting story. And Kim, I want to talk more quickly about where and how and what other things are you doing.
I just wanted to offer one quick plug, that's all. Just for I work at UH Manoa and the Environmental Center, and they're putting on an Earth Day celebration tomorrow from 10 to 2 right in the middle of campus. So if you end up anywhere in the university area and want to check out free products or go see demonstrations for sustainability, they're going to be having basically an Earth Day party all day long.
And you'll
tomorrow.
Be there with your Melly Honey.
I'm not sure if Nala Melly Honey is. I have a lot of different hats. I think tomorrow I'll have my Environmental Center hat on, but maybe I'll be I always end up representing bees no matter where I am. So
Yeah, Howard and Howard, folks, Howard has the Obama bees, you say, huh? let me see this caller right quick. Caller, good morning. You have a comment or question?
Good morning. I wanted to wish somebody a happy birthday.
Okay. Oh, that's right. I see how old I've turned 60, and I can't even remember. It is my birthday was just so. No. You're talking to an old man here.
Happy birthday.
Okay. Well, also I wanted to thank you. I'm your neighbor in Mililani, and thank you for being a spokesperson for the environment, for all of us, from all of us.
I know how
conscientious you are. And how much time you put on and you put into making Hawaii a better place for all of us.
Yeah.
And on this Earth Day, I want to thank you, Carol. Thank you very, very much. And that's why I called. Thank you so much.
All righty.
Mahalo.
Thank you. Aloha. Bye. Yeah, Howard, I'm getting gray. I love it.
Distinguished. You're getting distinguished.
Well, I won't know
right?
about that. I just keep my head down, but I just love the thought of getting old and gray, because that means I've had great experiences and hoping to look forward. You know, some say, well, you want to live, 40 more? No, I want to have the same life that I've had 60 years. If it goes that good, when you can care for other people and care for the environment, you've done good. You know, I don't want a headstone, tombstone. I want nothing. I want to just say that I was here. I helped, and I left. That's the way it is, right? So, Howard, tell us about this Obama bees. You got a little story. I just had to keep you in the studio and tell it because I like that story. These bees, are they liberal or Democrat?
I'm not sure. I haven't asked them. I just know that they're hardworking bees. I was called by the Secret Service in December about some bees in the house that Obama stays at, the Obama family stays at during vacation, and worked to remove the bees intact, alive. We got about 70 pounds of honey, which was roughly around 50 pounds of liquid honey and about 20 pounds of comb, which got distributed throughout the neighborhood. The neighborhood knew the bees were there and actually enjoyed having them there. They were kind of sorry to see them go and have asked me to bring them back. But the Obama bees, as I call them now, are now in Waimanalo and not exactly happy with me, because they've gone from a relatively dry environment to a very wet, rainy environment, which apparently has affected their ability to produce honey. But they're a hardworking hive.
Didn't you run them over recently?
Oh, I did. I did, unfortunately, knock the hive over. I backed into it with my body, not the car.
Sorry.
Working on the hive beside it, and I stepped backwards and forgot it was there, and ended up putting my hands out to steady myself and knocked the hive completely over, but I was able to write it back up before they even knew what was going on. It shows how slow some of the administration moves at times.
Ouch.
So anyway, I'm hoping that two things will come out of this. One is that I'll return the bees back to the general area, mm-hmm. so I'll be able to continue to produce a presidential honey, mm-hmm. and that they're being docile in nature, that I'll use them to start other hives.
Wow. So the community wanted them back.
Yes. Yes. They. A lot of the people didn't even realize they were there, mm-hmm. which shows, you know, how hidden bees can be. Mm-hmm. And the ones that did know about it were excited to see them there. They were really excited to get the honey. And in tasting the honey was when some of the property owners around there wanted me to come back after the first of the year and, mm-hmm. you know, set up bees on, you know, on some vacant lots.
The bees, the behavior of bees, I always draw and try to compare human behavior. So just recently, if you turn and look in the newspaper today, people were shot at the smokeout, the marijuana smokeout in Colorado, right?
Yeah.
But if you watch bees, man, you try to get that many people in one little area and see what happened. And then when you apply this, I call it the smoke, it's just as calm. Why can't people just smoke and be cool?
Well, you have to remember that the hive is all family.
Yeah.
They're all sisters.
Well, we come from the same tribe eventually
I think we're all family, too.
And inside the hive, there is no concept of, there's no egos. Mm-hmm. There's no coveting. There's no bee going, this is my honey. You know, mm-hmm. I made it. It's mine.
Mm-hmm. How do you know?
Well, I don't know. There's no scrapping. You know, bees won't scrap within a hive, although two hives will defend their hives from other bees. Mm-hmm. If you were to mix bees, there's a procedure that we have to follow if we're going to unite two hives, because otherwise a civil war will break out and there'll be nothing but dead bees, you know, around.
Stinging one another.
Right, because they can recognize, you know, which hive they belong to, which tribe they are. And but the society itself, for, like you say, having that many members of a society in such a small space, mm-hmm. we, at the end of the first day, you know, you'd put 60,000 of us in a, you know,
soccer stadium.
Yeah. At the end of the first day, there'd probably only be 30,000, you know.
Right.
And then there would probably somebody would want to be the, you know, the boss, mm-hmm. boss bee. There's no boss inside a hive.
Right. And the boss is going to want someone to pay for breathing air and then drinking a little honey.
This is my honey. You can't have any of it. There's a lot of things that we could learn by watching, you know, the bee society.
Yeah.
A couple of lessons I've learned is humility. Mm-hmm. That we do a lot of amazing things, but we can't fly.
Right.
We can't make honey.
Right.
We can't make wax. Mm-hmm. We can't make a comb that's as perfect as they do, you know, without using some sort of tools.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned that you can't be angry and work bees, because they will sense that and they will.
Really?
They will let you know. So you have to check whatever problems you have at the apiary door. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you're going to be in for a rough time.
Mm-hmm. What's funny, and I watched you over in Waipahu when you picked up that swarm, what appeared to be chaos was actually everything was under control. Every bee in that swarm knew their role. And when you put that smeared that pheromone or that attractant in the little box that you mm-hmm. had, and then put the box there, they all just start to walk into the box. Isn't that amazing? You got a bee call.
Yeah, somebody's.
Someone has a swarm.
I got bees.
But anyway, just watching that and seeing how they marched in, and I'm thinking, wow. I've watched other beekeepers, and in California, that was the whole effort. When you mentioned migratory
beekeepers,
that was, could you explain that, and then we'll.
Oh, here in Hawaii, we really don't have what would be migratory beekeepers, which are people who transport beehives mm-hmm. all throughout the United States to mm-hmm. pollinate specific crops. Mm-hmm. For example, towards the beginning of the year, almonds. The California almond crops will take about two-thirds of the commercial hives in the United States, roughly about maybe between 1.3 to 1.5 million colonies of bees. Mm-hmm. And they'll come from all over the United States. And the people are paying maybe up to $200 a colony mm-hmm. They get paid to bring their bees into the almond crops. They'll stay in there for a period of time, and then they'll pack them up, and they'll go up to Washington State for apples. Mm-hmm. Then they'll go out to like the Dakotas for clover or something else. Mm-hmm. And these bees are constantly on the move. And this is how a lot of those beekeepers, you know, that's their business, is mm-hmm. to provide pollination services.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want you to share a little light on that, because that is going in Southern California. You have them in Mid-Wasco and in Bakersfield area on the almond orchards, and then you might see that same guy later down in Calexico or Mexicali at the citrus mm-hmm. farms or the date plantation where they track the trailers loaded with beehives, and they're moving down the highway.
And every once in a while you'll see a news article about a tractor trailer full of bees, you know, jackknifing or turning over, and mm-hmm. you know, they'll say millions of bees and, you know, mm-hmm. 20 stings.
Right.
But it's a huge business, and it really goes along with the number that they say that one third of all the food we eat, you know, requires a honeybee, you know, in some form, either to pollinate that plant directly, that we, in the case of almonds or watermelons, mm-hmm. Or in the case of things that are fed to, you know, other animals that we consume the animals. Mm-hmm. So they play an important part, and the migratory beekeepers play an important part, you know, in getting, you know, the bees to the different things. It wouldn't be practical for an almond grower, although they do, to have 20,000 colonies of bees if the almonds are only in blossom for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. What's he going to do the rest of the time?
Right. Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it. And, folks, remember, it's Earth Day. And while I got you here for the if you could, I've never been able to get a straight answer from anybody, but being that the two of you know bees.
You think we get a straight answer from us?
I think I get a better explanation. Why is it that man and woman call one another honey?
We've never been asked.
You know,
that
this before. Is the bad thing about radio is you cannot see the look that Kim and I just gave one another. It's
well, anyway,
I think it's sweet, and so
maybe that's it.
There's some sweetness to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
in India, I think I knew a woman who used to call her husband eggplant because she liked eggplant more than anything. And so she goes, oh, eggplant. And it sounds nicer in Hindi. But so I think you just call your partner whatever you like the most.
So when she calls you nuts.
Well, there could be more than one explanation for that
one. You got a hard skull or something.
Maybe but she just likes almonds.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, folks, thank you for joining me. And Kim Felinski and Howard McGinnis, anytime, stop back in. And one more time, 258-7296. He took Obama's bees, so he know he can handle your bees. So anyway, we'll talk to you later, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on.
All righty.
All right.
So,
if you guys want to just stay around, or you can leave.
You're hungry?
But
yeah.
Anyway, what I was going to – I played that song, A Little Rail, there, and I want you to – just for 1 minute, I'll be back shortly.
Stepped in front.
Okay, welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. That was kind of nice and like that. I wanted to, this isn't rehashing old things. I just wanted to share with you, I did a little research and and great being, this is old news, but I just thought talking about it and looking back at things and regarding the rail, and you know, we, it's on its way here, and it's slowly being put in place by hook or crook, and every play from any playbook that you can think of. But what I did, I wanted to see some of the background, and I was quite curious about people like City Councilman Nestor Garcia, Romy Cocciola, Ikaiker Anderson, Breen Haramoto, and Todd Oppo, and a few others. What I was interested in is that there's this thing called Railvolution. And this is public knowledge, and it's not so much as it was what I'm going to be speaking about. It was disclosed, and it was voted and approved. But some of us who don't pay close attention to this or bother to go ahead and look and attend these meetings or see the city council meeting on Olelo, we wouldn't really know. But did you know that the Pacific Resources Partners actually paid in one instance, and I'll share the some close to $40,000 at least, that's what's reflected here, on for city employees that will have decisions on the rail, and also city councilmen paid their way to these things called Railvolution Conference, which in one of them took place October 16th through the 19th of 2011 at the Marriott Wardman Park Hotel. And I'm just going to read from Breen Haramoto's thing. And again, this isn't to say anything was wrong, but for me, if it was a proposal by the city, and it is the intention of the city, and it's a city project, the rail is, why didn't the city use its own money and not be influenced in this instance and taking money from the Pacific Resource Partners or anybody else? I mean, if it's a project that Grabowski and the others think that it's we should have and they're going to implement it, why didn't they pay out? Why have that burden of, I gave you airfare and I paid you thousands of dollars in expenses? But anyway, this is Haramoto's report that he made. And you can find this online through Honolulu.gov. So it's nothing new. They didn't conceal it. But unless you're paying, as I said, close attention to it, looking specifically for it, you would never know. But he goes on to say that last year, prior to joining the city council, I attended the conference in Portland, Oregon, that is. I personally paid for all expenses and attend that conference. It was such a great conference that I wanted to attend again this year to learn more about rail and TOD. Now, that's pretty admirable if in fact, Breen Haramoto took upon himself. I'm moved by the things that I do, and it's all voluntary. But if that is the case, my hat's off to you, Breen, that you would take money out of your own pocket and travel to a conference that's about rail, and all you were a citizen, and that's admirable. But this year, the conference was held in Washington, D.C., with over 1,200 attendees. In attendance were Transit Authority board members and staff, Departments of Transportation staff, Department of Planning staff, transportation consultants, planning consultants, and elected appointed officials at the city, county and state levels, federal levels. There was a large contingent of people from Hawaii attending the conference. In addition to five council members, there were people from the city administration, state government, and private sector. Pacific Resources Partnership funded the conference travel expenses for several council members, council staff, department planning and permitting staff, administration staff, and other city interested parties. So noticeably missing were staff from the Department of Transportation Services, who will hopefully have the opportunity to attend this conference next year, because we learned that at this conference, planning and transportation must work together for good TOD. But anyway, I read that, and then I reflect back. I know that this was a done deal, this rail thing. They walked it in, herded it in by hook and crook. That was the marching orders. They took left nothing to the imagination to get this thing in. And so it doesn't come as a shock to me that Pacific Resource Partners, who you know was quite active in paying and donating money for the campaign of mayor. So you think about this. Who picked the people in DPP, the employees? Well, it had already been planned, and I'd reported this a long time ago, that certain people had either retired and were brought back to work specifically on the rail under Mufi Hanneman. And they were diverting people's time and money, city employees, to work on the rail issues. And in turn, this whole thing was just building up and contributing. So it's no shock that Pacific Resource Partners, that paid for this. So Garcia, imagine the amounts of monies and what have you. You take, here is one, I'll just read the, to take a gift from an entity in the city. The city has a process where if you offer the gift as a private entity, you then must have it approved by the city council. So in this one here, that was a resolution. So as I say, it wasn't anything that was hidden. But again, it raises some eyebrows or questions as to why didn't the city officials say, no, we don't need to take money from others who might want to influence us, then we will just spend our own money because we had money set aside. So why would we be giving millions to the various parties that early on, Parsons and what have you, and then turn around and become welfare kids to have our own people to attend such, quote, important and educational conference? It just raises some big questions as to say, and it points to that there is some collusion going on with our city officials, namely Caldwell, Trudy Saito, the Mufi Hanneman, and others. And then also to include the former city prosecutor, Peter Carlisle. So they didn't just get the bill passed or get it approved through the voters. They didn't just sit there and rely on that. They got behind the scenes and start working and start taking money. And I question this. I really would like to know what the, quote, ethics commission or the ethics enforcement officer, Chuck Tato, would think of this. But I think I'd be wasting another tree in ink if I were to write to him, because he's part of that process, this process to someone should have said, just the appearance. And then how the big question is, how did they and who picked the people to work on the rail in DPP, and who picked them to go on? And these resolutions and some of the letters talk specifically as to who was going to go on these trips. But the resolution 11253 relating to the acceptance of a gift to the city and county of Honolulu for five city personnel to attend the Rail Revolution the Railvolution 2011 conference from October 16. Whereas though a letter dated August 25th, the executive director of the Pacific Resources Partnership submitted a request to the council for the acceptance of a gift to the city from the Pacific Resource Partnership valued at approximately $17,500 for travel and lodging expenses for city personnel to attend the Railvolution Conference in Washington, D.C. Now, my question would be, I don't recall there being a public meeting, and there may have been, but somehow I don't know everything, but how did they sit and meet and decide that it would cost $17,500, and who selected these people? And I didn't recall seeing a public meeting where they had names in a hat and the public participated and what have you. So how did they arrive at this, and did Pacific Resources Partnership have direct relationship with the mayor, who then brought in his director of planning and permitting and the other agencies behind the scenes? Where is that information publicly? Where are those meeting minutes? Where are the recordings? Where did the public participate? To arrive at $17,000 and $17,500, that would be. So the question is, you know, many of you know who Pacific Resource Partnership is. The president, or I guess the executive director, is John White. So the declaration of gift, the Pacific Resource Partnership desires to give the items described below to the city and county of Honolulu. To carry out this purpose on behalf of PRP, I hereby absolutely and without condition or reservations give, grant, and convey the below description of the gift. And again, at $17,000. And what will happen, Revolution registration fee, airfare, hotel accommodations, ground transportation to and from Washington, D.C., and Denver, Colorado, for five delegates from 16 through 19 October 2011. Approved submitted by request through Ernie Martin, and obviously you know the history of Ernie Martin, ran against John White, and Ernie Martin wants the rail too, so even though they would have appeared to be arch enemies, or one beating the other out by a few votes. Again, Martin didn't, he is the actual party that submitted that. But what goes on here? Is I want to share with you here's Harimoto's Transportation Committee Chair agenda. Councilmember Breen Harimoto of the Transportation Transit Planning today applauded the recent awarding of two additional contracts for development of the rail transit. I don't believe that Breen Harimoto is as innocent as he presents himself, and that's just my suspicion. Reading back into this, I think that he is put on this face where I'm the guy, the level-headed guy who stands in the middle of the road and going to make decisions as you present the facts and the documentation and whatever. But I think that he was like Cocholo, Garcia, and others who weren't really open and clear and honest about the real intentions and their activities behind the rail and their support, their commitment to this. Because if you read some of the reports that they submit, it suggests that they are already predisposed and just writing and articulating in a fashion that it leaves you thinking that he's objective. But in reality, the way my take from this is that he was just as committed from day one as he was today, or as he is today. So the awarding contract for the second, this is what he wrote on March 22, he being Harimoto, the awarding contract for the second phase of the guideway construction to Kiwi Infrastructure West and Core Systems contract to Ansaldo represent positive and significant milestones in the project's progress, said Councilmember Harimoto. However, it is still vitally important that the City Council conduct its due diligence thoroughly, monitor the details and progress of these contracts. how on earth can you write something, regurgitate something like this, unless you've just have some bad intentions, when you know that PRP is funding employees to travel the city? Now, if he felt that this was such a great deal, why didn't he just ask for monies from the contingency fund or ask for special budget needs or borrow from the rail, whatever that was due? Why reach back and have PRP involved? So I raise these questions and just give you some ideas about some of the expenses that individually, like Todd Oppo went there in May, and this has been going on now since 2007. So this was I'm going to describe it as a conspiracy of sort. And then they bring it back as if it's all being processed and it's an open process and you, the public, get to comment and you go to the hearings. And when, in fact, if you look at the visitation and how they all gravitated to this revolution, only a select few. So bring in some big questions. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question?
Thank you for taking my call. Not of a sort, an absolute fact. Years ago with Mufti, who went back to Washington, D.C. to get the contract, Brain Horimoto has been responsible. How did he become a city council member? The facade, the rhetoric he gives does not comply. It's not consistent with his actions. Mm-hmm. He and Berg had so many arguments across the table. And Berg was for the common good of the people, and Breen was for the rail. Yes?
Okay. I agree. You there, Richard?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not looking to attack Breen, but I'm looking to – I'll call this the OB, outing Breen, because I don't like to be the sucker – especially the sucker taxpayer. And I don't like to have, and I suspected and have said this on the show, Breen's reaction to Tom Berg's was an unnatural reaction, because most adult human beings would have just said, well, I disagree. He pounded the table. So what? But I looked into Breen's statements and his behavior. The only thing he didn't do is call a missile strike on Tom Berg, and the punishment would not have fit the crime. So I look at this, and I have some serious concerns about this. And I want to share with the listeners out there.
Can I make one comment about Americans with disability?
You help yourself.
The CFADR, American for Disability for a Fair Ride, has been given the opportunity to use the second floor council room once a month for some time. Mm-hmm. I do not know the entire length of the time, but once a month they can meet there. There have been people there who are impaired in so many different ways, giving so much testimony, and never once has he brought up a resolution before the city council, the entire council, on behalf of these people. Mm-hmm. I had read a resolution on the behalf of these people, and there has been no reply whatsoever. I wasn't there. I had to go to the doctor, but someone supposedly was supposed to read that for me. Now, he wants to make a resolution about the consolidation of rail, van, bus, but he's never had a resolution about the people from CFADR. Mm-hmm. And forgive me, I want to be objective. I've given him enough time. He is less than what you... I am very, very angry with him.
Well, we just need to if pin the tail on the donkey, so to speak.
Yes.
And I don't mean to be foul-mouthed about... but I'm taken aback by this process. And what I would also say... There's another resolution. I told you about some monies, but here's one, 11253 CD1, proposed it was. And I'll just, regarding revolution, relating to the acceptance of a gift to the city and county of Honolulu for the revolution. And in this, now, you heard me say that it was about, whereas the transit-oriented development falls under the purview of the council zoning and planning committee, the council chair designates committee chair Ikaiker Anderson and committee vice chair Romy Cocciola as a council attendees. And whereas attendees from the city administration will be Jiro Samada, Deputy Director of Department of Planning and Permitting, Terry Ware, Transit-Oriented Development Administrator, Kristen Eads, Deputy Managing Director, and whereas the description and value of the gift set forth in the declaration is $17,000, $17,500. So, again, how did we get to this point, and how did PRP get the information to know this kind of information? Did they serve as travel agents, or did the city put together these people and then pick? How did it happen? I'm just curious.
What you said before about no minutes, no transcriptions, go back to the original five people who were picked for the technology for the rail. Where are the minutes? How long did they deliberate? How were they picked, and who picked them? And what you just said, I'm taking notes, 1125C3 gift. I take notes in what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I am furious. I calmed down for a while, but it's beyond conceptual object for me.
Now, I've taken this information directly from the city, and again, obviously, it isn't hidden, but, you know, when they make their travels, number one, they don't file a report immediately upon their return. So you would have to have a specific interest to look at this.
Yes.
And yes, the resolution, but at that time when it's done, it's and depending on how it's handled. But I find this to be of interest because I want to let yes, it's going to create jobs. And the thinking today in this town is that I believe it's as just as easy in the near future that we will have a nuclear power plant situated on our property. You know why? Because it makes jobs, but no one is thinking about the overall impacts.
Wow.
So here's another, I guess, a resolution or a FD1, Florida. Whereas through letter, the executive director of the Pacific Resource Partnership submitted a request to the Council of Acceptance of a gift to the city and Pacific Resource Partnership valued at $22,000 for travel and lodging expenses for city personnel to attend the revolution in Washington, D.C., to visit in several transit-oriented. Whereas a transit-oriented development falls under purview of the council zoning and planning, blah, 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 the council designates committee chair Ikaika Anderson, vice chair Rami Cocciola, committee Ann Kobayashi, member and staff member Laura Figueroa, as a council attendees. And whereas attendees from the city administration will be Jiro Samada, deputy director. So, again, resolutions talking about, and this one is $22,000. Now, I don't know how and why. But it really bothers me that this kind of behavior, when in fact, and they all voted for it, right?
Forgive me, but it's easy for me to make the connection.
Yeah. Well, you know, and again, this is stuff that is out there, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but to me, it's offensive. I guess that's how I would describe it. Hold on 1 second. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question? Good. Hey, you got a question on rail right quick? Because I'm busy talking with another caller. What you got? Real quick
I
now.
I think the road transit system is, like, not good to Hawaii because, you know, it's kind of confusing.
Okay.
It's kind of confusing, like, to have rail because how are you going to know what the bus routes are, you know?
Right. Like right now, you don't know where they are, and they leave you hanging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for your comment. All right.
You know what he just said about mm-hmm. the aesthetics for Hawaii is exactly right. And mm-hmm. what Caldwell said is he's going to hide the elevated guideway behind buildings and put trees.
Yeah. Well, see, this thing, I'm sharing this because, you know, the Pacific Resource Partners raises some great concerns with me and their behavior inside of our government. And that is, here's a letter, for example. They're not just stopping at the rail. Aloha, Chair Garcia and members of the council. This is written on January 26, 2011. Here's what they're writing. Mike Kito, External Affairs for the Pacific Resource Partnership, a labor management consortium representing over 240 signatory contractors and the Hawaii Carpenters Union. So now we know who some of the PRP activities are. PRP strongly supports the confirmation of Samuel Moku as a director of community services. If they support him in this effort, then where was he in his earlier government jobs? If you look where he was, it was a shambles. And if you go over to see the cover-up that's going on in the department that he is now running, the Director of Community Services, which was our Ernie Martin. And this is, if you remember, I talk about the grants and donations that were given to nonprofits that goes unaccounted for in the millions. And then I was also able to confirm through employees of these folks that they were shredding documents and hiding from HUD.
I remember.
So this is what the kinds of people that PRP props up and send. You don't get this endorsement just because you go to church with them or drink beer with them. There's another element or something. And, again, here's another one for the – they're nominating and to Chairman Kito is, again, strongly – Tom Berg introduced 11-328. Initiating an amendment to the revised charter of the city and county of Honolulu in 1973 as amended relating to the public. They oppose that. Mike Kito writes, and so they're not just, and they have their right. This is their right to comment and participate and object. But for us, it starts to answer questions. How do we get where we are now with this rail? How do we get there? Because there were a lot of backdoor dealings. My goal is to try and give you, the listener, some examples, rather than just say there's the booga bear is in the closet or somewhere in there. I'm going to try and pinpoint some of the specifics. So, and not to say they're doing anything wrong, but I want to see transparency, which we didn't have in the beginning.
Your term conspiracy, as far as I am concerned, is absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a computer, so I rely on you and others to tell me. I'm going to try to get a computer, though, and
well,
God bless you. I listen to you every morning and sometime, but this issue has just enraged me.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much.
All righty. You're welcome.
Bye.
Yeah. And you tell me as a listener, am I overreacting to this? Because I have a tendency to, you know, I'm human we all need a little polishing. But I cannot tell you, when you read something and it's more nauseating, it's like eating a spittle bug. It's the equivalent of that. You see a spittle bug, you know, it's just, and you grab it and eat it. This next comment that I'm going to read is rise to that level. It is members of the city council pursuant to the provision of article in an overabundance of caution, I disclose that I am executive director of the Kapolei Chamber of Commerce, which has expressed its public support of the rail project. Nestor Garcia. Always an abundance of caution. How about an abundance of money being stuffed in your pocket and under your door and your envelopes and whatever? How about that? That is when a person presents. This is we got guys in city council. I had guys, and Breen is still there. I don't know if I would be fair to say Haramoto and Garcia and Cachola and Ikaika, the new kid on the block, they're teaching him as well. And they are so sincere. They go and attack Tom Bird. And they then Cachola, you know, he raised the issue about it should be situated closer to the airport, when in fact he was already predisposed and knew what he wanted because they were putting money in his pocket, giving him these tours and these flights and going to the county meetings, or National Association of Counties and what have you. And then they go off to Bombardier. These records show that they went to Bombardier. Bombardier is the place where Mufi Hanneman, by the way, went in Pittsburgh to have that illegal fundraiser. So how is it that they all gravitated here and they all were able to get airfare and all of that paid by PRP, and they all got the marching orders to go to Bombardier and participate in their meetings and then go and talk to the our state delegates? Why didn't they wait here to talk to the delegates? Anyway, this is the thing that causes me great concern. And I posted some pictures up on, as it's already been reported, the rail is here. There's the actual rail is here. And you can see them over there at Kalailoa or at the Deep Draft Harbor in Barbara's Point, in Camel Industrial Park, we'll call it, next to the Chevron station. But there is something terribly wrong with this entire process. We should demand a full investigation, a criminal investigation, not just a flowery audit, because that would just make you more frustrating. But we, the taxpayer, brace yourself. There's going to be more of this nonsense, because that's the nature of these guys. They are destined to rip us off, because they're going to get, their consortium is going to get money in the turn of building something that really is not, in my opinion, or in the stats and whatever that are presented, will never rise to the occasion of solving our problems with traffic and reducing the slow hours and the rush hour problems and the potholes and all of that. It's just going to be with this this community of politicians, it's going to forever remain the same. It's going to get worse. It's just going to be one more monkey on our back. So anyway, I have much more to talk about that, but we'll get back with you on it. And I just think that we need to really take care of this thing. And again, it's Earth Day. Run out to Haleiwa or whatever you can do. Stop and pick up some trash or whatever and make it look better, because what they're doing to us, I know, make you want to throw cans against the wall. But I'll talk to you later. Aloha.
Thank you for tuning in to the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. right here on K108. Tune in again next time for the Carol Cox Show, right here at KWAI Honolulu.